Good afternoon. I'm George Terwilliger, and I'm privileged to be here with these two fine gentlemen that I will introduce in a moment. I wanted to just bring a couple of things to your attention at the outset of this, what promises to be a truly engaging discussion. One is we're going to leave, because of interest in the topic, a fair amount of time for audience participation, which shall be oral only, no throwing anything. And I would ask respectfully that I know there are many strongly held views about this topic, and I'm sure many of you could sit up here and offer your own commentary that would be of great interest to people. I would ask that when you participate, and we certainly encourage you to participate, please do so by asking questions, and as the moderator, I'm going to reserve the right to cut people off who are speaking rather than asking questions, so thank you. I'm off to a good start. Thank you for that support. In introducing this panel, I thought I would try to provide a bit of context, and I hope you don't find this context that I offer too obscure. Since 2001, the nature of the terrorist threat that we as Americans face has become more asymmetrical rather than less. Terror organizations have become more diffused, both geographically and organizationally. A significant aspect of that diffusion, which we have seen a horrible example of in Boston recently, is that we now face a homegrown threat. And I think this in turn results from a number of factors, but two that are worth mentioning. First, the phenomena of domestic self-radicalization. And if you're interested in this topic, that is, what kind of intelligence collection do we need to do, particularly electronic collection, I urge you to make every effort to understand the phenomena of self-radicalization. The other, and a related one in my view, is an immigration policy that seems to refuse to discriminate between those who come to America to assimilate their culture with our own, and those who come here with absolutely no intention of doing so, but rather come because they despise our culture and values. Under current policy, we unfortunately welcome them both equally. The British, I believe, made this mistake ahead of us, and London Stan resulted. A further contextual factor for the discussion we're going to have in a moment here is an appreciation that we have an administration that seems to be comfortable with outright lying to the American people. If Nixon had a credibility gap, this president has a credibility chasm. Leave Obamacare representations aside, in the national security sphere, it's now obvious that intentional false statements were made regarding what took place in Benghazi. And actions since appear to have all the hallmarks of an intentional cover-up. If we put these few factors and some others together, asking whether this administration can be trusted to establish and maintain an intelligence policy that is grounded in substance rather than political considerations becomes a very significant question. That makes the distinguished experts, like our two panelists here today, voices to whom we should listen, and experts whose counsel we should heed. Jeremy Rabkin, to my left, is a professor of law at George Mason University. His full bio is available to you, but I would briefly note that he serves on the board of directors of the U.S. Institute for Peace, on the board of academic advisors of the American Enterprise Institute, and the board of directors of the Center for Individual Rights. Judge Michael Mukasey, to my right, is a partner at Debevoise & Plimpton. He previously served as Attorney General of the United States for 8 years and as a U.S. District Judge. Served as the Attorney General for a number of years and for 8 years as a U.S. District Judge, where he presided, as I'm sure you know, over a number of cases related directly to terrorism. He also served in the position that's near and dear to my heart as an assistant U.S. attorney for 4 years. The format here will be that Judge Mukasey is going to speak for a short while to be followed by Professor Radkin, and then we will ask for a little bit of a further exchange about their respective remarks between the two, and then open it up to your questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Sometimes it seemed like 8 years, but it wasn't. First a little setting of the stage for the setting of the stage. The threat that we face today is largely as was pointed out, foreign. When we talk about the domestic aspect of that, I think it's dangerous to think of it as self-radicalization, because the folks who become radicalized either overseas and come here or in the United States didn't come up with the doctrine themselves. They did not devise the various rules and regulations that they think that they're following in order to do or try to do what they're trying to do. These come from abroad, and they are a radical strain of Islam that has been in the ascendancy lately, and it's the same strain of Islam that's been in the ascendancy abroad, and that's where they get their inspiration. Whether they get it directly by going over there, or they get it indirectly by going on the internet, that's where it's coming from. And that, I think, makes necessary the two programs that I'm going to be talking about today. One is the gathering of so-called bulk gathering of information under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Now, that section requires that somebody who has possession of records produce tangible things, including books and records, as well as the information contained in them, so as to get foreign intelligence information that does not concern, i.e., that does not target a United States person, and it has to be based on statements of fact that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the items that are going to be obtained are relevant. Relevance, by the way, is defined as not only direct relevance to a particular case, but potential relevance, and that's very important when you're talking about the nature of what is taken in a 215 collection. Section 215 was reauthorized in 2011. The head of every relevant committee, that is the intelligence committees, the armed services committees of both houses, were briefed or offered briefings on this. In fact, all members of Congress were offered briefings on this. And so the suggestion that members of Congress, particularly members of Congress who should have been in a position to know about this program, have about them the denials of Louis the Prefect in Casablanca. I'm shocked to find that there's gambling, which of course he says just before his winnings are given to him by a nearby officer. The information that is gathered under Section 215 that has come under scrutiny and under controversy is so-called metadata from telephone calls in the United States. Metadata consists only of the number doing the calling, the number that is called, the duration of the call, and the date. That's it. It has nothing to do with content. That is the same information that is in the hands of your telephone company, which is where it comes from. It is not content, which it is unlawful for your telephone company to have. It's unlawful for anybody to have unless they've got authorization based on a warrant issued upon probable cause. Nobody gathers content. And the government storehouses this information for a limit of 5 years. So what good is a mountain of millions upon millions of telephone calls that list only the number called, the number doing the calling, the date, and the duration? Well, it comes in great handy when we find a telephone number overseas that is connected to a foreign terrorist organization, a safe house, or a place where terrorists have been plotting a project like the blowing up of airliners over the Atlantic back in 2005. We find that. We can go to that trove of information and find out whether any of the telephone numbers that are associated with that location and with those people have called or been called by any of the numbers that are in that trove of information that has been stored. We could also bounce out a couple of levels from those numbers to find whether there is a circle of people who appear to be in contact with one another and with a foreign terrorist organization. This is enormously important because it is the only outward-facing intelligence gathering program in the United States, the only one. And if we tinker with it and mess with it, we are going to be crippling ourselves. As I said, this cannot be used for the purpose of targeting a U.S. citizen. Is this not a search? No, it is not a search. The information is in the hands of a third party. It is information in which it's already been held that the subscriber has no reasonable expectation of confidentiality, simply because this is the kind of information that's used by your telephone company to compile your bill. Move on to 702. Section 702 of FISA permits the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to jointly target non-U.S. persons who are reasonably believed to be outside the United States to acquire foreign intelligence, not just national security information. Foreign intelligence, including information that's useful to us in trade negotiations, in the conduct of foreign relations, and in other aspects of our relations with those abroad. But it certainly does include, and emphatically does include, intelligence information. And it is permitted to be gathered so long as the FISA court approves the procedures for acquiring the information and for minimizing the possibility of any violation. The FISA court has examined both of those programs repeatedly, the 215 authorization every 90 days since 2005, and the same for the 702 acquisition, and has found them perfectly acceptable, perfectly lawful. There have been recently and regrettably suggestions that because of scandals in other departments of government, including the IRS, including other agencies, including the Department of Justice, that somehow the information that is in the hands of the NSA is suspect and could suffer the same fate as the information that is in the hands of the IRS and other agencies of government. I'm here to tell you that there is no such thing as the United States government. They're just a bunch of people and a bunch of different departments. Some of them are honest and intelligent and dedicated, and some of them are none of the above. As it happens, the IRS has a long history of, on occasion, being none of the above. The NSA, by contrast, has no such history. The NSA was born after World War II. In fact, at one time, its existence was so secret, it was claimed that the initials NSA stood for no such agency. And it has attracted, over the years, the service of the most dedicated, skillful operators, people who are devoted to only one thing, and that is protecting the national security of the United States, and to wake up with only one nightmare, having survived only one nightmare, and that is the possibility of another attack on this country. The people who have access to the body of data gathered under 215 number fewer than 20, and they can consult that data in the event there's a foreign connection only upon specific approval by their supervisors. That entire program is supervised by, count them folks, three branches of government. One, obviously, NSA itself and the executive itself. Secondly, Congress through its oversight committees on a periodic basis and when those statutes have to be renewed. And the FISA court, which was inserted into the process as a safeguard and to provide a safeguard for the gathering of information. Some people have suggested that the number of applications or the proportion of applications granted by the FISA court is somehow an indication that that court doesn't operate effectively because they grant nearly 100% of the applications submitted by the government. In fact, it's possible to interpret that statistic in two ways. And I recall when I was Attorney General, a certain police commissioner of the city of New York interpreted it as the government's not making enough applications. It's like drilling for oil. If you don't drill a certain number of dry holes, you're not drilling enough. What I pointed out to him, what I point out to you is that the Justice Department, which makes application to the FISA court to get these authorizations, has as its most valuable commodity, it's a high standard of credibility with that court. And they draw the line very carefully and temper their applications very carefully to make sure that they are clearly on the side of legality. And when there's pushback, as there sometimes is, they pull back and reconsider. That explains the nature of the interaction between the department and the court, and the proportion of applications that are granted. Now, there have been, of course, in every time there's a scandal, there are calls for reform, and I hate to hark back to people who were associated with the Nazi government during World War II, but every time I hear the word reform, I reach for my revolver. The latest reforms are largely pitched toward making it more difficult to get information, cutting down the nature of the information that can be gotten. One reform, in quotes, calls for introducing an advocate on the other side, just for the hell of it. Let's have somebody arguing the other side, assuming that there is that the court itself and that the prosecutors exercising their restraint don't consider the other side, which of course is an invalid assumption. Now, I should tell you that the introduction of the FISA court into this process is something relatively new. There was a time when intelligence information could be gathered, and intelligence information outside this setting can still be gathered without the intervention of any court at all. What the Fourth Amendment restricts is not all searches and seizures, but unreasonable searches and seizures. And the warrant requirement tends to apply principally in cases where you're talking about gathering information for to prosecute crimes. It was never intended to curtail the gathering of information to protect the country. And I think what we have to make sure to do in these times is to resist the possibility that it's going to be used that way, because if it is used that way, we're all going to be the worse. Thank you very much.
Well, let me start by saying I totally agree with General Mukasey. Casablanca was a totally great film. I agree with everything. I should just like start with disclaimers. The Fourth Amendment, I don't know. I've taught con law many times. I never go near the Fourth Amendment. It's totally confusing. Glove compartment is one thing. The trunk is something else. I have no opinion about it. Someone else can raise that. And then there are the people who, you know, they're very concerned about the secret surveillance from the grassy knoll. I'm not going there either. I really want to just give you the perspective of a citizen. That's one thing I'm really qualified to deliver because I am a citizen. And from the citizen's perspective, let me say, we have a lot of uneasiness about the NSA. But don't just take it from me. There was a recent poll I came across just in the past week, which seems to show that the American public has more support for targeted assassination than for data mining. And that's not the bad news. The bad news is they think the targeted assassination is being done by the NSA. Really, I mean, they'd say, well, like, why don't you do the stuff that works instead of fooling around with all this data? I think the central difficulty is obvious. I mean, we do need to have surveillance. It's in the nature of surveillance that it's not effective unless it's secret. So most of what they're doing, we don't really have much understanding of. That means we don't know how effective their work is, and actually we don't know very much about abuses. People who keep saying, oh, there's no abuses, what they mean is they haven't confessed to any abuses, because almost everything we know comes from reports which they make on themselves. I'm not saying there are terrible abuses, but it's a little bit unnerving that they're out there gathering all this material for, we don't really know for what exactly. Let me tell a little cautionary tale. In 1962, President Kennedy sent airborne troops to Mississippi when there was commotion and violence about desegregating the University of Mississippi. And then he mentioned to people in the Army, you know, we should have seen this coming. Do you, like, gather information about this? And they said, well, we haven't actually that much, but we'll be on it, sir. And a few years later, President Johnson said, wow, these riots in Detroit and Newark, we didn't see this guy. Did the Army know about this? Because he had to authorize the National Guard to go in. And they said, oh, we're working on this, sir. And when the Nixon administration came into office, it turned out there was a considerable program of domestic intelligence gathering by the United States Army. And a question was raised in a new administration, is this really lawful to have the Army gathering intelligence on American citizens in the United States? And the question got bumped up to Assistant Attorney General for Legal Counsel, some guy from Arizona, who said, the Army should not ordinarily be used to collect intelligence of that sort. This man had the making of a Supreme Court justice. Right? William Rehnquist said, you know, makes me a little uncomfortable, but who am I? I don't know. Well, it's not exactly illegal. So it kept going, and the year later, there were articles about it, and then there got to be a whole commotion about it, and a senator in the Democratic majority, Sam Ervin, said, this is really of concern to me. We need to look into this. So everybody remembers the Watergate hearings, or older people remember this. Sam Ervin, the star of that. But he got warmed up for that, looking into the abuses by the Army. And in 1971, he said, before Watergate had happened, he said, what's disturbing about Army surveillance is it not only lacked civilian control, it also lacked central military control. People who thought we needed to gather intelligence were just gathering more and more intelligence on more and more things. It turns out they had reports on the John Birch Society, okay. Martin Luther King, not so good. The Urban League, I mean, they were just anyone who they thought might be a little, they were gathering stuff. And I take Sam Ervin at his word when he said, we looked through all this stuff, it was not helpful information. They just had the impulse to gather more and more. Now you might say, that was then, this is now, the NSA is totally different. Maybe it's totally different. It is presided over by a general. In fact, it is really an extension of the Pentagon. And a lot of things have happened in the past few months that make people uneasy, and I just want to say, rightly so. Let's start with Snowden. The really shocking thing about Snowden is, how did he have access to all this material, which he's now shared with the Russians and the Chinese and the Guardian and other enemies of ours? The really shocking thing is this came about 2 years after Private Bradley Manning downloaded all the diplomatic cables of the United States, and everybody said, oh, that's a little embarrassing. But apparently it wasn't that embarrassing, because no one did anything about it. Nobody was fired. Nobody even was disgraced. Hillary Clinton, who, you know, was Secretary of State, everyone said she was a great Secretary of State. All of her cables were released to the public, but still, she was great. And the NSA said, well, maybe that's embarrassing for them, but, you know, I mean, we don't actually need to have controls over this. It's I think it's just stupefying that this could have happened. It's supposed to be in the government that when you download things, people, you know, see who did it and why, and people in the end, I mean, I actually talked to one intelligence person who told me, oh, well, he used not his real name. That's how he did this. I thought, oh, okay, that's really... because Carlos Danger, how could they know who that was? But anyway, General Alexander didn't get in trouble because it happens all the time, you know, that like all of your secrets of a secret agency are divulged by a contract employee who didn't go to college. That could happen to anyone. I'm sorry, I'm about to get serious. So General Alexander did get in trouble because it came out that he was spying on Angela Merkel. That is serious. And Angela Merkel, of course, complained, and then the White House said the president didn't know. And a little bit later, General Alexander or someone on his staff gave journalists to understand, actually, he didn't know. We told him he should know. And everyone just said, oh, well, maybe they told the president. Maybe he was busy supervising the healthcare website and didn't hear. I mean, this is like a pretty basic, serious thing. Yes or no? Did the president know about this? So there's two possibilities. One is the president is just lying and his staff thinks it's okay. Or really, the NSA is out there doing all kinds of stuff and the president doesn't even bother to say, this is really interesting what you reported to me this morning in the Daily Intelligence Brief about Angela Merkel saying this, this, and this. By the way, how do you happen to know that she said these things? My serious point is when General Alexander said or allowed people to say in his name, no, the president is telling a falsehood, either he should have been fired or he should have resigned. I mean, this is actually a very serious thing, and we treat it as, oh, well. Now, General Alexander is not the most senior intelligence figure. That is James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence. He is supposed to be institutional oversight over both the NSA and the CIA. He testified before Congress last spring. He was asked, does the NSA save phone records of Americans? And he said no. And then he corrected himself, because you have to be careful under oath. He said, well, not wittingly. And then it came out, well, no, of course, we do have phone records of Americans, millions of them. But he said afterwards, I thought the way I explained this was the least untruthful. Now, again, this is just outrageous. He should have resigned or been fired. I mean, people just like, oh, well, you can't expect him to actually tell Congress exactly, really. And this is the same person who, at just about the same time, testifying before another committee in another hearing, was asked about the Muslim Brotherhood. And he said, well, it's really a secular organization. I think by secular he meant not Christian. But really, that's not good enough, right? This is the guy who we're supposed to be reassured, James Clapper is on the job. He's making sure they don't do anything crazy, right? And what you learned from that exchange was either he would just say anything to kind of reassure the White House. This was at a time when we were supporting Morsi's government in Egypt, so the White House wanted to say, yeah, it's fine, don't worry, this guy's gonna be okay. I mean, he's like, he's not Christian, don't worry. Or else he is a complete buffoon. Which is it? I don't know, but again, nobody's saying he has to resign. Everyone's saying, well, like, yeah, I mean, sure, I mean, well, whatever, you know? The FISA court, which is supposed to be, I don't know the inside of this, but I do know that there have been several episodes. Now the Obama administration, after Snowden released all these things, said, oh, yeah, sorry. We want to reassure you, so we're going to release opinions of the FISA court, which of course all were secret, and in these secret opinions, which were now released, some redaction, there were a number of decisions in which judges said, hey, you didn't explain this before. Hey, you misrepresented things to us. So the FISA judges themselves don't seem totally confident. Let me just bring this to a conclusion. But say one more thing before that, which is, meanwhile, the Obama administration is extremely cavalier about secrets. It isn't just that somehow they hire guys like Snowden. They released this information about Stuxnet. They released this information about the Osama raid. Just last week, Israel's furious. They released information about an Israeli strike in Syria. For whose benefit were you revealing that you know this and all the details of it, right? So they're very cavalier, and what that says is they regard secrets as raw material for the White House, which the White House gets to deploy whenever it is convenient for the White House. If that's the way they think at the top, how can people be confident that the NSA will be guarding our secrets when people in charge of the NSA and the people in charge of the people in charge of the NSA basically just lie down and let the White House say and represent it however they like? There was a poll last summer by Pew, a very reputable polling organization, which found 70% of Americans believe the NSA uses data for other purposes than combating terrorism. It's over when 70% of Americans think this is just gathering information. There was no real response. President Obama said, we need to have a debate about this. It's good to have a debate. And it turned out what he meant by that was, you go out and argue, I'm busy. He didn't participate, he didn't defend it, he didn't explain it. Just by chance, I was 2 nights ago at a GMU event where my now GMU colleague, General Michael Hayden, former director of NSA, former director of National Intelligence, gave a talk, and he said the following, which is what I wanted to say, but it's always better to use somebody of more stature to get your message out. He said the NSA will not be allowed to pursue even overseas intelligence gathering if it does not recover the confidence of the public, and I think that is totally correct. And as somebody who is usually rather hawkish, and as I said, is not too interested in the Fourth Amendment, I think we got to take this very, very seriously. People should be forced to resign. There should be accountability. We should take it very seriously. And if we don't, there are all kinds of proposals now to restrain the NSA, and it's going to be hard to deal with them because 70% of the country thinks they're just gathering information to use for all kinds of purposes. It's totally a disaster for the NSA. It's a disaster for national security. I think it's a disaster for America. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. I thought I might ask two questions to get this session going, and if you have some response to Jeremy that you'd like to make, please do.
Okay.
From here?
Yeah, wherever you like.
Taking the some of the points in the order in which they were made, polls generally about people's view of the NSA, I think, are a terrific barometer of how much misinformation has been spun into this, not necessarily a barometer of what is out there. But I agree that public confidence is at crisis. The point of that is, or the lesson I draw from that is, that you don't run around howling for somebody's head. Rather, you talk the truth about what goes on at the NSA and what doesn't. So far as how Snowden got to be hired, that story goes a whole lot further than the NSA. Snowden was in the armed forces, got out on a I believe, a medical discharge, notwithstanding that one of his favorite avocations was kickboxing. I kind of like to know how that happened. He was a bit of a malcontent. He got himself a medical discharge. He then went to the CIA, where he had a checkered career, but got out or negotiated his way out with his clearance intact. That's how he came to be hired by a private company. That should never have happened, and the answer to that is not at the NSA, it's at the CIA. All of that said, there should have been no way for him to do what he did, and I gather, although this does us no good, that they were about to institute a system at the NSA that would have prevented him or anybody else from doing what he did, which was essentially to shut down the system and isolate it so that he could get information. So far as Bradley Manning is concerned, I know you all, everybody in this room I'm sure has credit cards, and you get a telephone call every so often from your bank asking whether you're in Bimini. And generally the answer is, no, I'm not in Bimini, in which case you know that somebody's been using your credit card and they stopped your credit card. Most banks, all banks do that. I don't understand how it is that some corporal in the Army can download hundreds of thousands of sensitive documents without what every bank has lighting up and saying, what the hell is he doing with that information? So I agree that something should have been done and somebody and some heads ought to roll, but not at the NSA. So far as the NSA gathering information for purposes other than protecting national security, that's true. They do. They gather it for every foreign relations purpose that we have, including our negotiations with other countries, our relations with other countries, our checking up on whether our friends are in fact our friends. And this is known by other countries. In fact, they rely on our intelligence gathering to help their intelligence gathering, and frankly would be sore and hard put if it were limited. Thank you.
I just want to respond to the Snowden was not the fault of the NSA because they were going to fix that problem. And it had happened previously somewhere else. It happened previously somewhere else is the whole point. They should have looked at the Manning case and said, whoa, that reform that we were going to do, we better rush and do it quickly. Somehow they didn't notice that he was downloading things. And I was told, well, it's because he didn't download it all in his own name. But how is it that they didn't have enough control to verify when it says it's being downloaded by such and such, it really is such and such, right? We shouldn't say, oh, they're good guys and they just slipped up. This is really catastrophic failure. And if they are capable of catastrophic failure on something as important as this, how can you have confidence in them? And if there isn't accountability at the top, there isn't accountability. We're just basically saying, oh, well, these things happen. And these things don't just happen. When the Japanese managed to attack our fleet at Pearl Harbor, the first thing we did was to fire the commanders. Because you cannot expect people to have confidence when in commanders who have just presided over a terrible security lapse. And somehow we're treating Snowden as if it's just, you know, kind of, well, there was the previous panel you were on about reporters cooperating with the government, and it's just like reporters cooperating with the government. That's not good enough.
I see we have several questions, and we'll get to them in just a moment. I do want to ask one question, and I invite you both to comment on this, but I'll direct it to Judge Mukasey first. Judge, you mentioned an instance where an example of a communication with a foreign number that involves a known terrorist and then working out a couple circles from there. Could you very briefly describe a little bit more about what that means and why the metadata collection is important to that, and what the intelligence value of that kind of an operation is?
Well, I can describe it in an if we had known terms. On 9/11, we knew that two people named Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi were on their way to the United States. We didn't know where they were, and if we had had the kind of data that has been gathered by the NSA, we would have been able to find out where in the United States they were. Now, would that have stopped 9/11? I don't know. And if 9/11 had been stopped, I don't know that there wouldn't have been another one, because I can easily imagine the editors of the New York Times scoffing at the possibility that 15 guys with box cutters were going to bring down tall buildings. So we might have had another incident, but we might have stopped that one.
Jeremy, you remarked on not knowing whether or not these programs are effective. Given that kind of an example and the faith that people who have been in the profession have in the value of metadata collection, for example, and the ability to exploit it in real time, do you have a view on whether we should trust those statements of value by those who are doing the work?
Just to be clear, I'm sure it's very valuable, or at least it can be very valuable. Mm-hmm. And I am not saying they have to explain to us all the details of how it's worked for them in this and that episode, that you can't expect that. A lot of it has got to remain secret. But I think it is not reasonable to say to the citizens of the United States, trust us, we have top men on this.
Sir, you have a question.
Yes. You had said that the IRS is kind of a part of the government that we shouldn't trust, but we can trust the NSA, that they don't have a background of doing this kind of stuff. But as far as I'm aware, isn't it true that the Inspector General of the NSA said there's been dozens of cases of employees abusing the system, spying on their love interests, things like that?
No, it is not the case. There were, I believe it's something like 2,600 violations of the standards. Of those, upwards of 2,000 involved listening in on telephones that it was perfectly proper to listen to, except nobody kept track of the fact that the people carrying those phones crossed the border into the United States and stopped the listening. That was the nature of most of the violations. There were six instances in which NSA employees kept track of loved ones who were traveling abroad. Six.
Let's all understand, this information that you're alluding to, the Inspector General gets because the NSA told them that. And since they didn't know about Snowden, do they know about the employees who are doing more egregious spying? That's a serious question and not a smart alecky question. I think the answer must be they're not very good at monitoring their own employees. And their own employees may have a lot of potential for abuse. So that, yes, I think that is worrisome.
Two other points. There was reference before to data mining. There is no data mining of the data that NSA gathers. And it would be very valuable to mine particularly the Section 215 material. You could find out all kinds of things by sitting down and analyzing patterns. They're not permitted to do that, and they don't do it. And so far as whether you, so far as it being a trustless argument, ultimately it does generally come down to that. If the choice is between trusting the people at NSA or trusting the people in Al Qaeda who are going to read about how we do what we do and act on that, I'd rather trust the people at the NSA.
Yes, sir.
Representative James Sensenbrenner, who is the author of the USA Patriot Act, went to Brussels last weekend and addressed the European Parliament, where he made what I think is an extraordinary admission. I'm just going to give a little quote here. He said, quote, "The NSA has weakened, misconstrued, and ignored the civil liberties protection we drafted into the law."
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Okay. This is Representative Sensenbrenner. He said that the NSA has weakened, misconstrued, and ignored the civil liberties protection we drafted into the law. It ignored restrictions painstakingly crafted by lawmakers and assumed a plenary authority we never imagined. Worse, the NSA has cloaked its operations behind such a thick cloud of secrecy that even if the NSA promised reforms, we would lack the ability to verify him. Does the panel think that Representative Sensenbrenner has a point?
Whether he has a point or not, he is the last person in the world who ought to be making it, because of the information he actually had and the information to which he had access. I'm not saying that he is exactly Louis the Prefect, but he's damn close.
Sir, I'm sorry, all the way in the back first and then we'll come back here. Go ahead, sir.
I was struck by one comment that was made regarding the idea of having someone to disagree with the idea that we ought to make data collection merely for the sake of having someone to disagree. The foundation of our profession, as I'm sure everyone knows, is argument and the discovering truth through opposition, whether it's in criminal or civil matters. And in fact, a society was founded just because we felt there was too little debate in law schools. So when it comes to the civil liberties of Americans and the comparison of what we ought to do, I am curious how we can say that it is aligned with the standards of our profession, of the Federalist Society, of the ideas of the separation of powers, or of the ideas of limited government, that one part of the government, without oversight, checking itself only, will not even have a single individual within itself with access to the same information who will stand up and, for the sake of argument, disagree with his colleagues.
And I'm going to add take a prerogative to add a dimension to that question. And that is, given the constitutional underpinnings of the authority to conduct intelligence gathering activities, at least on a foreign persons and a foreign basis, is the proposal for the advocate yet another erosion of the executive authority which underpins all of this activity? And is the FISA court itself not an erosion of that authority?
The answer to your second question, the answer to both of those, the second and third questions, I guess, is yes. Because The president is charged, among other things, with protecting the United States, and that, contrary to the question asked in the back, is not an adversary proceeding.
Have a view on the advocate and where that fits into a constitutional system?
I have to say, I'm skeptical of the advocate. I was impressed. Federalist Society has this journal now, Engage, and they published a statement by Stuart Baker, and he made what I thought was a very telling point, which is the advocate will be raising very abstract issues in secret. And this is not really the best way to have a considered debate even about should we undertake this particular surveillance. So I think it's likely to be either grandstanding that won't be helpful to national security or kind of going through the motions, right? Because it's all in secret and the actual targets aren't informed or present. So I'm not very drawn to this as a remedy. I think the remedy has to be we have to be able to trust the people who are put in charge of this, and if we can't trust them, that's a very, very big problem.
And thank you for mentioning the Stuart's article in the Engage Symposium. Those of you are obviously all interested in this issue. The Society's publication Engage has, in fact, a series of articles in a published symposium, which may be available outside, I believe, at least some copies of it, but can be obtained, that is really a very informative piece.
And let me just add, because it's extremely topical, there's a very interesting article about the Fourth Amendment issues, which Professor Barnett might want to address because he's the author.
Sir.
Thank you. Randy Barnett from Georgetown Law School. I was going to mention that I do have a piece in that Engage symposium raising the Fourth Amendment and statutory Section 215
see how well
problems.
Orchestrated
it really
we
does.
Become.
It's all a seamless
and,
web.
And has written other excellent pieces as well.
Thank you, Judge. And I'm actually going to preface my remark. I just want to preface my remark, Judge McCasey, by saying how much I admire the service that you've done to the for the country in your service as a judge, and in particular working on terrorism activities as a judge, and in your service as Attorney General of the United States under very trying conditions.
Thanks. Thanks very much, but now comes the but.
Yeah, I felt it was important. Felt it was very important to preface this. Much of your argument today is what you might call an appeal to an authority, and that is that you're telling us, on your authority as former Attorney General, that this is what is happening, and this is not what is happening. And if you hear otherwise about what you say is not happening, then you're hearing misinformation. We know there are a lot of press reports that are of seemingly good base of a sound basis for a number of programs that are not involved. They're not the Verizon telephone metadata programs. There are other programs of interception, for example, with Google servers that are not encrypted, and therefore there's interception of email traffic, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to get into the weeds of that, or Fourth Amendment, or Section 215. I just want to ask two simple questions. One at the more specific level, how can you be sure, even as Attorney General and now especially as former Attorney General, that the facts are what you believe them to be? I don't doubt you believe them to be that. I want to know where you get your confidence that those facts are in fact what's going on in the NSA and elsewhere. That's my first question. And my second question is, under a theory of Republican government in which the people are ultimately supposed to be holding their representatives in check, including, for example, Representative Sensbrenner, too. He's just a representative. He's an agent. He is not a principal. How is it possible for the people to hold their agents in government accountable if they don't know the basic parameters of the programs that the government are using? I'm not talking about the details of investigations that we don't want to know anything about. I'm not talking about that. We don't need to know about that. We don't need to know about specific sources of information and techniques of information. But in general, if there is a general surveillance of citizens of the United States, if there's a program like that, how can we as a people in a Republican form of government hold our representatives accountable for that program if we don't know that program exists until we're told by a leaker named Snowden or Manning or someone else? How does that work in our system of government?
I think the way it works, answer the second question first. I think the way it works is to come up with acceptable descriptions of programs that do not disclose operational details or do not disclose them in sufficient detail for them essentially to defeat themselves. And that's a taxing job, and I guess we've all learned recently that it's got to be done better. And I'm in favor of having it done better. But that said, there has to be, I mean, because it is a program of intelligence gathering, you will agree, I'm sure, that a lot of it has to be opaque. Otherwise, ain't no point in having it. Correct?
As a general matter, right. Okay. But I do agree with that. But
as a general and as a specific matter. So far as how I can be confident that what I believe, in fact, is what happens, it's based on my own experience and my own interaction with the people involved. I also believe in considering probabilities. There are N people involved in intelligence evaluation at NSA. There are 300 million people in the United States. What would be the point of gathering information for recreational use or gathering information for any other use than protecting the country when the thing that these people most fear is an attack on the United States? And it is what they are going to be held responsible for if there is one. You know, we've gone through periods of periods that Jack Goldsmith called cycles of aggression and timidity, where the intelligence community goes out on a limb and gathers information, then isn't backed up by the political branches and retreats, and there are gaps in information, and it's gone on and on since the Pike Committee and before. We witnessed it after 9/11, where people talked about why they should not be hesitant to be aggressive in gathering information.
Can I just ask?
We've got to come to a median point.
I just want to know if I understand the answer to the first question, the one you answered first, correctly, accurately. I'm not putting a new question. Did I understand your answer to be that we do need to be informed about the existence of these programs in general? Like, for
yes.
example, that there
yes.
is data. There is data collection of all our phone activities, not the substance, but all our activities. We need to be told there's a program like that. If the NSA is intercepting email traffic with Google servers, let's say, and then they're having access to this, and we should be told as a general matter.
If disclosing it at that level of detail will not interfere with the ability to use it, yes. But I can tell you now that when you mention specific service providers, you then create the incentive for people overseas to use other service providers. And they are. And they have responded that way. And it's a lot harder now for us to gather information from those service providers than it is to gather information from, say, hypothetically, Google.
Sir.
Thank you. We have heard today about, and of course have read, about the relative ease in which two low-level people, Snowden and Manning, were able to access the heart of the NSA databases and other databases. What confidence do we have that Al-Qaeda, the Iranians, or whomever, haven't also accessed this data? What confidence do we have that the NSA itself and its computers haven't been hacked? And if that has happened, are we in the ironic situation of having this huge data collection taking place, ultimately for the benefit of enemies of the United States? So again, to just repeat the question, how do we know that the other side, the other guys, bad guys, are not only accessing this data, but massaging it and mining it in a way that works against the interests of the United States, in which case we may have actually put the bullets in the pistol and put it to our head, and they're going to pull the trigger.
Generally, the proof of that particular pudding is in the eating. And on an ongoing day-to-day basis, we screw them a whole lot more than they screw us.
So
we're better at it.
If I may, just bear with me one second. Yes, sir, in the back.
Yeah, Rod Sullivan from Florida Coastal School of Law. It has been suggested to me by some people that the FISA court is not a true court because it's not an Article III court. It's not subject to judicial review. Its members are not appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate. They don't serve for lifelong terms. And that really the FISA court is nothing more than another administrative agency that's overseeing another administrative agency under Article I. do we really have judicial oversight here simply because we have Article III judges sitting on an administrative agency?
Professor.
I'm not going there. It's a good question.
It's an excellent question, and it has an anomalous role. It, I guess, theoretically could be reviewed by the Supreme Court. It was put there by Congress. I suppose you'd have to ask them. I wouldn't weep real tears if it disappeared.
Thank you, sir.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm Sam Miarelli from Orlando. I'd like to take a look at the economic impact of this. Silicon Valley, these firms that the NSA has been spying on, create a tremendous amount of wealth and jobs in the United States. And we've seen, in the wake of this, and even sort of associated with this, programs like LavaBit, Hushmail, GrokLaw, been shut down, not because, as you reported, Judge, that they were just handing over their documents, but because they were being ordered to maintain documents they wouldn't otherwise maintain for the express purpose of handing them over to the NSA. And I just wonder what the panel thinks about the tremendous negative economic impact that we're already seeing of our intelligence services shutting down programs that are creating jobs, shutting down companies, because they don't sufficiently protect NSA's records.
So what?
I think that's a very, very serious concern. I mean, all around the world, people have now come to understand that when you deal with American tech companies, you're also dealing with the NSA, and that is bad for the American tech industry. That's very unfortunate. Now, maybe it's worth it because they're getting so much valuable stuff, but if you don't just take it on faith that, oh, yeah, those guys are great, you know, they're like right up there with James Clapper. They're just so smart. If you're a little bit skeptical and you remember, wait, these are the people who decided to take government jobs, right? They're not in Silicon Valley making a huge pile of money. They're instead working for the government. Maybe they're not so smart, and maybe they are doing what people in the government always do, which is, it's not costing me anything, so gimme, right? Maybe they're like all bureaucrats and regulators. Then you really start to think, damn, this is a concern.
We're running close to the end, and I want to get the last question, but I am constrained to make an editorial observation, I'll call it. I think it's very curious that in an age when we have voluntarily surrendered our privacy through social interaction, through electronic means, we exhibit this incredible distrust of the government to collect that information in order to keep us alive. But go ahead, sir.
Gerald Wolpin of the Board of Visitors of the Federal Society. First, I have to defend our moderator who spoke about 8 years for service of Judge Mukasey. I think you were really not misstating but expressing the wishful thinking of all of us here that he were the incumbent in the office today, not the other one. I have a question for Jeremy, my good friend. You make a wonderful case for why we should not have elected Obama, who has appointed so many poor people to their positions of responsibility. But how do you reconcile that, your position of worry about it, with the need to still have security services and to have intelligence gathering without throwing out and you speak about it as if you want to throw out the baby with the dirty bathwater, what would you do when you have to rely on, unfortunately, the president who is in office to appoint people who may not appoint the best people, but you have to continue the procedures that will be well utilized, better utilized, by a better president?
So I don't have a real good answer, but I would start with this, which is there should be accountability for disasters that have occurred. The accountability should start with people at the top, and then the next thing that happens is the president has to nominate someone else to head the NSA, and those hearings will be very, very consequential.
How do you force him to do it?
Say it again?
How do you force the president
to do something right? What will happen is that in the course of his confirmation hearings, the successor will have to answer to a lot of questions and probably give some undertakings. No, I promise we won't do this. And that's why we have that procedure of confirmation, to impress on the nominees that these are serious concerns that we have.
Okay, last question, sir. Please go ahead. We have just about 2 minutes, panelists.
My brother served as a volunteer with the Marine Infantry in Afghanistan. My brother-in-law flew the first daylight airstrike on Baghdad in the first Gulf War. I think that I and my family don't take second place in terms of the notion of defending the United States against its enemies. However, my question to the panelists is this. How can you say that the kind of intrusive, expansive, and I think and to some degree unauthorized, certainly by the American people, activities that are being talked about here and the ones that we don't yet know about could be congruent and consistent with the principles of limited government that are so vigorously and I think so well defended and promoted by the Federalist Society?
I think that was a question for Judge Mukasey, really.
Gee, thanks. I think the way they can be defended is the way they were defended in the Federalist Papers, by saying that we had to have as vigorous an executive as it took to defend this country. None of us is urging that we adopt a program of surveillance of all of us. On the other hand, as George pointed out, and I wanted to underline this, and I had planned to do it even before you asked your question, we have, perforce, because of the time we live in, surrendered a lot of our privacy. I was the beneficiary, if you want to call it that, of a demonstration by a civilian company. This is not the military now. This is a civilian company that has the capacity to drop an electronic bubble over any place in the world and listen to all the Twitter feeds and all the other social media that come out of that area and find out what people are saying and at what level of intensity. Now, that can be very useful, but what it means is that a lot of people who assume that their communications are restricted to a very narrow group of people are acting under an incorrect assumption. Those are the times we live in. But I do think that we need an executive that is vigorous enough to defend what freedoms we have and cherish, which include the freedom to have discussions and debates like this, against people who would deny them.
I'm sure I join the panelists in thanking the audience for your excellent questions, and I hope you'll join me in thanking the panelists for an excellent